Sopi Janabalamba Janabalamba Ask the Tara such a she, Shimadi Divine Grace, Sri Bhakti Vedanta Swami Maharaj, Prabhupada Ki Jai. ISKCON founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Sri Vaishnavind Ki Jai. Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai. Prem Shikaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Adwaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhaktivind Ki Jai.
Jai.
Jai. Shri Radha Krishna Go Gopina Shyamakunda Radha Kundi Giri Govardhan Ki Jai. Vrindavandam Ki Jai. Mathuradam Ki Jai. Navadvip Mayapuradam Ki Jai. Jagannath Puri Dham Ki Jai. Gangamai Jamuna Devi Ki Jai. Bhakti Devi Ki Jai. Shri Maharani Ki Jai.
Jai.
Namaveta Bhakti Vrindi Ki Jai. Gaur Premanand.
Hey, hey, Bo.
All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasaya Vishnu.
Are you finished?
Swami Namaste Namaste Sarasvati Devi. Gauravani Pacharane Nivasesa Srinivadi Paschacharya Sakarane Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Ita Parakamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavam Cha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Samsajivam Sadvoitam Sadvaditam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lavita Shri Vishakam Vitam Cha Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. It's June 28th, 2011, Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 10, Departure of Lord Krishna for Dwarka. These are the words of the ladies of Hastinapur, text 28.
Yunam vratasnana huta dineshvara.
Yunam vratasnana huta dineshvara.
Samarchito yashya grihita panibi.
Pribantiya
sakya damamrita muhur.
Pribantiya sakya damamrita muhur.
Rajastriya samum muhur yadashaya.
Braya Rajastriya samum muhur yadashaya.
Please chant.
Pushkarji, you want to chant? Is this sound off? Nunang vratasnana hutadineshvara.
Nunam vratasnana
hutadineshvara. Samarchito hyasya grihita panibi. Samarchito hyasya grihita panibi. Pipantiyak sakyadharam ritang muhor. Pipantiyak sakyadharam ritang muhor. Prajastriya sammu muhor yad ashaya. Prajastriya sammu muhor yad ashaya.
Someone else?
Nunam vratasnana hutadineshvaraha samarchito hyasya grita panibiha pibanti yak sakhi adarmritam muhur vraja striyaha samamuhur yat ashayaha.
Anyone else?
Somebody else? Not a hard verse.
It's a beautiful verse.
Okay, I guess we'll go to the word for word. Nunam.
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 Certainly in the previous verse. In the previous birth.
Certainly in the previous birth.
In the previous birth.
Vrata.
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 Vow.
Vow.
Snana.
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 Bath.
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 Huta.
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 Sacrifice in the fire.
Sacrifice,
sacrifice
in the fire.
Adina.
Adina. By all these.
By
all these.
Ishvaraha.
Ishvaraha.
The personality of Godhead.
The personality of Godhead.
Samarchitaha.
Samarchitaha.
Perfectly worshipped.
Perfectly worshipped.
He.
He.
Certainly.
Certainly.
Asya.
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 His.
He.
His.
Grihita pani bihi.
Grihita pani bihi.
By the married wives.
By the married wives.
Pibanti.
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 Relishes.
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 By the way, pibanti literally means to drink. Yaha.
Yaha.
Those who.
Those
who.
Saki.
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 O friend.
O friend.
O friend.
Adara Amritam.
Adara Amritam.
The nectar from his lips.
The nectar from his lips.
Muhu.
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 Again and again.
Again and
again. Again and again.
Rajastriyaha.
Rajastriyaha.
The damsels of Rajabhumi.
The damsels of Rajabhumi.
Samum Muhu.
Samuhu.
Often fainted.
Often fainted.
Often fainted.
Yat ashayaha.
Yat ashayaha.
Expecting to be favored in that way.
expecting to be favored
in that way.
Ramananda, are you going to mute people or are you there?
Ramananda? Hello? Hello, Ramananda.
Sorry, I had to unmute myself in order to talk. Okay, I'm going to mute everybody at this time. Sorry for technical difficulties.
No problem. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Oh, friends, just think of his wives, whose hands he has accepted. How they must have undergone vows, baths, fire sacrifices, and perfect worship of the Lord of the universe to constantly relish now the nectar from his lips by kissing. The damsels of Rajabhumi would often faint just by expecting such favors. So before we read the purport, we can just note here that these women in Hastinapur, they're considering, in one sense, Krishna's married wives to be more fortunate. They're focusing on the wives. They're saying that the gopis of Vrindavan, Rajastriyaha, they're fainting, wanting to kiss Krishna, but Krishna's wives are able to have that ecstasy available all the time. So it's just an interesting note that although on the one hand, one can describe the different relationships with Krishna and the subcategories of relationships with Krishna in terms of higher or lower from an objective point of view, each devotee feels that their own particular relationship with Krishna is the best for them. And it actually is the best for them, and they feel that it's superior. And the reason why each devotee has their particular relationship with Krishna is precisely because that's the relationship that the devotee relishes the most. The devotee is, it's not that the devotee is thinking, oh, there's higher relationships, but, oh, well, I guess I just have to settle for this one. No, the devotee is thinking, this relationship I have with Krishna, it's the best relationship. Even though technically some other relationship may be higher, actually I don't like it so much. I don't think it's so nice. So that's a little side note to consider here. All right, we'll read the translation again, then go on to the purport. Oh, again, this is the wives in Hastinapur speaking. Oh, friends, just think of his wives, whose hands he has accepted, how they must have undergone vows, baths, fire sacrifices, and perfect worship of the Lord of the universe, to constantly relish now the nectar from his lips by kissing. The damsels of Rajabhumi would often faint just by expecting such favors. Purport. Religious rites prescribed in the scriptures are meant to purify the mundane qualities of the conditioned souls to enable them to be gradually promoted to the stage of rendering transcendental service to the Lord. Attainment of the stage of pure spiritual life is the highest perfection, and this stage is called Swarupa, or the factual identity of the living being. Liberation means renovation of the stage of Swarupa. The word renovation, interesting word. Liberation means renovation of the stage of Swarupa. So renovation means something already exists, but somehow it's fallen into disrepair. I remember many, many years ago, my husband and kids used to watch this these videos called This Old House. And my son, who was fixed the shower the other day in the house, said that he learned a lot about fixing things by watching those videos. So those shows were about some construction crew. They would take old houses and they would renovate them. They'd fix them up. By the way, that's a lot harder than building a new house, generally. So Prabhupada says here, liberation means renovation of the stage of Swarupa. And the word Swarupa, Swa means his, Rupa means form. So we each have our own form that needs to be renovated, and that is liberation. Liberation is not nothingness. Okay, going on with the purport. In that perfect stage of Swarupa, the living being is established in five phases of loving service, one of which is the stage of Madhurya Ras, or the humor of conjugal love.
The Lord is, Prabhupada means humor here, not in terms of funny, but like we talk about the humors of the body. It used to, kind of old English. Going on with the purport, the Lord is always perfect in himself, and thus he has no hankering for himself. He, however, becomes a master, a friend, a son, or a husband to fulfill the intense love of the devotee concerned. Herein, two classes of devotees of the Lord are mentioned in the stage of conjugal love. One is Swakiya and the other is Parakiya. Both of them are in conjugal love with the personality of Godhead Krishna. The queens at Dwarka were Swakiya, or duly married wives, but the damsels of Raja were young friends of the Lord while he was unmarried. The Lord stayed at Vrindavan until the age of 16, and his friendly relations with the neighboring girls were in terms of Parakiya. These girls, as well as the queens, underwent severe penances by taking vows, bathing, and offering sacrifices in the fire as prescribed in the scriptures. The rites as they are not an end in themselves, nor are fruit of action, culture of knowledge, or perfection in mystic powers ends in themselves. They are all means to attain to the highest stage of Swarupa, to render constitutional transcendental service to the Lord. Each and every living being has his individual position in one of the above-mentioned five different kinds of reciprocating means with the Lord. And in one's pure spiritual form of Swarupa, the relation becomes manifest without mundane affinity. The kissing of the Lord, either by his wives or his young girlfriends who aspire to have the Lord as their fiancé, is not of any mundane perverted quality. Had such things been mundane, a liberated soul like Sukadeva would not have taken the trouble to relish them, nor would Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu have been inclined to participate in those subjects after renouncing worldly life. The stage is earned after many lives of penance. Nunam vritasnana huta dineshvara samarchito yasya grihita panibihi pibantiya sakya dharmam ritam muhur rajastriya samum muhur yad ashaya. O friends, just think of his wives, whose hands he has accepted, how they must have undergone vows, baths, fire sacrifices, and perfect worship of the Lord of the universe, to constantly relish now the nectar from his lips by kissing. The damsels of Rajabhumi would often faint just by expecting such favors. So everyone is working hard. Everyone is doing sacrifices. Everyone takes vows. Everyone has some determination. I'm going to go to work every day, and I'm going to make a lot of money, and then I can buy the house and the car I want, and then I will enjoy. Or even nasty vows. I'm going to work hard to steal money from this house, and then I can enjoy. Whatever. But everyone has some determination. Everyone engages in some sacrifice. As Krishna explains in the Chatur Sloka of Bhagavatam to Lord Brahma, that he creates, maintains, and destroys the world by penance only. So by some sacrifice, by some giving, actually that is the dharma of the living entity, to give. We say to serve, to give, to sacrifice. That's our nature. Of course, in conditioned life, sacrifice means going through some difficulty in order to achieve some aim. The problem in this world is that often all we achieve is our difficulty. Our aim is, the so-called success is illusory. Of course, our difficulty in one sense is also illusory. But what we want to attain in this world is not an actual goal. It's not a real artha. It's an unartha. It's an unwanted thing. And generally, we engage in sacrifice and vows and austerities life after life to get things that are not satisfying. But here the women are glorifying the wives of Krishna and to some extent the girlfriends of Krishna, who after engaging in proper sacrifice and austerities achieved the greatest goal. So they had both the ultimate goal and they also knew how to achieve that goal. Whereas in conditioned life, we have the wrong goal and we often have the wrong means also. We don't know what should be achieved and we don't know what kinds of sacrifices and vows and austerities we should undergo to achieve them. We think that our goal is getting a good education, and our sacrifice and austerity should be cramming for our exam and taking out college loans. We think that our success is having a lot of money, and we think that our austerity is working hard until we are foaming at the mouth. But we don't know what is the goal nor the means to achieve that goal. And the reason that we don't, and the reason that these other persons do, is identity. Identity. So these jivas who became the wives of Krishna or the lovers of Krishna, they understood my identity, Jivara Swarupaya Krishna Aranityadas. That I am a soul. I am a soul. I have nothing to do with the body. I am a spiritual being. I am in the same quality of Krishna. Najayate miyate va kadachid nayam bhutva bhavita va na bhuya ajo nicha sasmito yam parano nahandite hanumane shavide. So psychological, sociological research shows that the way we decide what is our goal and how to achieve it is based upon who we think we are. It's based upon who we think we are. Just like there was a problem in Texas with people throwing litter on the highway, and they discovered the main litterers were young men. So they realized that these young men, they had kind of an anti-authority mentality. And if they said to them, now if you throw litter on the highway, you'll be punished, that they would simply do it more. So they got these tough guys, very top celebrities, sports figures and stuff, who were also native Texans. And they had this advertising campaign where these top sports heroes from Texas said, don't mess with Texas. Don't throw litter on the highway and mess with Texas. And that appealed to the identity of these young Texan men who thought, yeah, I'm a tough guy and I'm not going to mess with Texas. And so they stopped littering, and their anti-litter campaign was 70% more successful than ones that just said this is the right thing to do. Or in the island of St. Lucia, there was one parrot that the locals were eating. And when they told the people, they made an advertising campaign, this is our parrot, this is our native bird, this is our symbol of our island. Then people stopped killing the bird. So people do things based on identity. They think, I am a young married man. What does a young married middle-class man in Slovenia do in this situation? And that's how we make our decisions. So first thing one has to get is one's identity. One's identity. I am a soul. I have nothing to do with the body. Then as soon as we have our identity, then we can understand that the goal, as Prabhupada says here, the highest perfection is Swarup. He says, or the factual identity of the living being. So then we understand my goal is to act fully in my identity, to act fully as who I am. Of course, the problem is that in the beginning, one just has a vague sense of who I am. Right? You have an old house, and at first you just have some vague idea, I need to fix it up. The floors are sagging, you know, the paint's coming off the wall, the termites are eating the foundation, the roof is leaking. You know, I see the problems and I have some idea, okay, I want to fix this up. Then you meet with some contractor who can look at your old sagging house and they get a vision of what it has been originally and what it could be, how it could be restored, or Prabhupada uses the word here, renovated to its original condition. So one meets a guru. One comes in contact with the Shastra, and the guru says, oh, this is how you can be restored to your original pristine condition. And just like in renovating the house, there's so many austerities. First of all, one has to be willing to spend money. If you say, I want to renovate my old house, but I don't want to spend any money, then what will you get? Not much, right? What contractor is going to be willing to work with you for free? At least you have to put in the work yourself. If you're not going to spend the money, at least you have to spend money on the materials. Then you have to put in your time. And of course, your money is also indicative of your time and your energy, because you earn that money by working. In other words, you have to be willing to put in some energy. You have to forego doing other things in your life in order to renovate your house. There has to be some austerity. So when we learn, oh, I'm a soul, and my perfection is to realize myself as a soul and to connect with the Supreme Soul, and I have to be willing to undergo some austerity, not cheap. Now, there are many, many people in the world who say they want some spiritual perfection. They want to feel very spiritual, but they want it cheap. They think they're going to get spiritual perfection just by buying some crystals to put on the shelves in their house, you know, or just by doing some hatha yoga exercise, which Prabhupada calls childish activities, going to some club in a modern urban center and doing some poses. Oh, now I'm very spiritual. Or concocting their own process. Nowadays, some concocted religions have become very prominent, or people concoct things even in genuine religions. So, or I'll give myself a new name and then I'll feel very spiritual. Right? People want something cheap, something simple, something magical, you know, without any work, some kind of miracle. Someone wrote me a message like this on Facebook the other day. I'm so much suffering, I want some guru to come and just bless me. Hey, we want someone, that people go to some holy place and they think, okay, I'll just go to this place and kiss this rock or touch my head to this thing and poof, you know, then everything will be renovated. But it has to be some sacrifice. Why some sacrifice? Why vows? Why vrata snana huta? Why snana? Why a bath? Right? So I take this bath both literally and figuratively. Literally, that one has to take one's body and immerse it in water. One has to be externally clean. But also, more poetically, and one has to be willing to clean oneself. And this is said in the first book, verse of the Shikshastika. It's like a bath for the self, purifying for the self. So why is that necessary? I mean, if this is who I am, if my factual identity is as Krishna's servant, is as Krishna's relation in one of these five rasas, in one of these five saibhavs, why can't it just be here? Why do I have to do anything? Or people have the philosophy sometimes, well, everybody will achieve it, just go on, do whatever, and it'll just come to you. Why? Because we've turned from it. Bahirmukhe, we've turned our faith. We have intentionally walked away from who we are. You know, I know one young man, very nice family. He walked away from his family and became a heroin addict. So although his mother and father love him, his mother has cried so many tears for him, still, it's not that if he just says, okay, Mom, I want to come back home, that he can come back home. If he comes back home, he'll simply steal their money and use it for his heroin addiction. And then under the influence of the drug creates so many problems. So they say, my dear, we want you to come back home, but first you have to undergo a treatment program. And the treatment program is going to be some austerity because of this artificial attachment that one has taken on willingly. So we have willingly, knowingly, taken on so many artificial attachments in this world to which we become addicted, to which we have allowed to control our life, and weaning ourselves from this addiction, that takes some difficulty. It requires some bath. It requires some vow. It requires some ritual. It requires some austerity. And our main addiction is not to illicit sex, intoxication, meat eating, and gambling. Our main addiction is not really to the external behaviors. Our main addiction is to Ishwaraham Aham Bhogi. Thinking, I am the Ishwara. Here in this verse, it says one has to do vows and baths and sacrifice to the real Ishwaraha, to the actual Ishwaraha, Ishwara Parama Krishna, Satchidananda Vigraha, Nadir Adya Govinda, Sarvakarana Karanam. The real austerity is removing myself from the center where I don't belong and putting myself in the circles around Krishna. The circles of Rasmila, the circles of eating with Krishna as a cowherd boy, the circles of cows surrounding Krishna. With him as the center. That is actually the austerity. And everything else, as Prabhupada mentions here in this verse, in this purport, that fruit of actions cultivate knowledge, perfection, and mystic powers, whatever one may do, religious rituals, as he says here in the very beginning of the purport, they're not simply of their own. The purpose of doing these is not to do them. The purpose is to get myself out of the center. Sometimes even devotees become stuck on the platform of the externals. They become stuck on the platform of the process rather than the purpose of the process. They get stuck on the letter instead of the spirit of the law. They get stuck on what I'm doing instead of why I'm doing it. And such persons are very critical of those on a higher platform. So here we have persons who actually understood who they are, what is their goal, and what to do. And the ladies are talking about such persons, the wives of Krishna. So let's look briefly at the wives of Krishna. I suppose before we do that, we should just again reiterate Prabhupada's point in the purport that this is not mundane. We should not think that Krishna and his wives or girlfriends are on the material platform. They're not engaged in some sense gratificatory process as we see in this world in terms of conjugal love, romantic attraction, sexual attraction. It's not like that. This is not some biological process they are engaged in, nor is it some process of wanting to satisfy my senses by using the other as an instrument of that satisfaction. No, it is what we romanticize that conjugal love is in this world. It is the reality about which in this world we have a fantasy. In this world, there's the fantasy of happily ever after, of intensely romantic love, something where there's a full meeting and union of two hearts and two minds, a full giving of one another. So that is our romantic ideal. That is not in this material world the real. In this material world, conjugal attraction is simply between the two machines. It's not actually a meeting of the souls. They talk about soulmates, but it's not like that. It's a relationship between the bodies, which are not the self. At best, it's a meeting of the minds, which are also not the self. The mind is simply a more subtle machine. But in materialistic life, for materialistic persons, conjugal love just simply means a meeting of the minds and the body. Or sometimes only the body, sometimes not even the mind. And even then it is not so perfect. It is not that the bodily union or the mental union of lovers and spouses in this world is even always or nearly always or mostly always satisfying even on a material platform. What to speak of the fact that it doesn't touch the soul? It's not a real thing. It's not real love. Real love is a total giving of self for the benefit of the other, which we can imitate, but it's not there. Anyway, we have some idea of this. We have some idea of it in the fairy tales and the romance novels and the movies, and of course men and women each have a little different take on what is the romantic ideal, but still we have that conception. It's there, the many musicals that come out of Bollywood, you know, where every step is a dance and every word is a song and everyone lives happily ever after in a difficult union and so forth and so on. But we should understand that this relation with Krishna is that reality in perfect form. It is actually love. It is the prototype of love, the prototype of complete giving of self, selfless giving, of total union yet total autonomy, simultaneously, completely being oneself yet completely giving oneself, of merging of two and yet remaining separate, of two soul, one soul in two bodies and yet two entities, forever, always getting better and better, with unlimited happiness that is derived from the happiness of the other, and full of variety of emotions and variety of activities, laughing and joking and games and lovers' quarrels and mending of the quarrels and so-called jealousy of other lovers and everything. Like they say, the standard plot for the romantic movie is boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl back. So this goes on between Krishna and his beloveds also. Meeting and separation, losing and finding, arguing and making up, joking and flirting and everything is there. It's not like it's just some boring union where you're just one forever. No, it's not like that. It's full of variety, ever increasing, always new, always fresh. So that is the reality of which we are looking for here in our pale reflection, our pale distorted reflection, like a tree reflected upside down in the water with the moving ripples distorting the tree. And if one goes to pick an apple from that reflection in the water, instead of a sweet, crunchy apple, one simply gets his hand wet. So in this ultimate spiritual reality, Krishna in his incarnation on earth, he married 16,108 queens. And we'll look at their coming with Krishna and their austerity. First, there's Rukmini. Rukmini was pledged by her older brother to marry Shishupal, who was a great king in the world, but an atheist and adverse to the Lord. And she, just by hearing about Krishna, she begged him, please kidnap me so that I don't need to marry this Shishupal. So Krishna did that. The next wife he married was Jambavati. She was the daughter of Jambavan, called Rikshiraj, the king of the bears, which doesn't mean, by the way, that he was a bear. I know in the Indian movies he's always a bear, but Prabhupada said he wasn't a bear. Prabhupada said, why would Krishna marry a bear? he said Jambavan is like a black African man. So that was Jambavati. And Krishna married her after fighting with Jambavan to recover the Shaimantaka jewel. And when Jambavan understood that Krishna was his lord, Ramchandra, he gave both the jewel and Jambavati. And the children of Jambavati were Krishna's pet sons, very spoiled sons, like Samba. Then the next queen that Krishna married was Satyabhama. Satyabhama was given to him in marriage, also in relationship to the Shaimantaka jewel. When Shatrajit realized that he had defamed Krishna, he gave his beautiful daughter Satyabhama to Krishna to marry. And Satyabhama is often considered Krishna's favorite wife. So Rukmini is the chief wife. Jambavati's sons are Krishna's favorites, and Satyabhama is Krishna's favorite wife. And Satyabhama is a very demanding wife, by the way, and a very jealous wife. Then after that, Krishna went to Hastinapur to meet with the Pandavas after they were found alive. They were supposedly killed in the burning of the house of wax, but after showing up at Draupadi's Swayamvar, everyone understood they were still alive. So Krishna went to see them again in Hastinapur and stayed for the 4 months of the rainy season. At that time, when he was out on a chariot with his friend Arjuna, he found the presiding deity of the Jamuna River, Kalindi. She's the daughter of the sun god and the sister of Yamaraj, the god of death. She was performing great austerities in a house under the water until she could marry the Lord. So he took her back to Dwarka and married her there with pomp. He married also Mitravindra. Mitravindra had two brothers who were under the control of Duryodhan, and they had arranged a swayamvar where she could choose her own husband. she was very much attached to Krishna, and she chose him, at which time he had to forcibly take her away because her brothers were very much in opposition to him. Then Krishna married Satya, the daughter of Nagnajit, and Nagnajit had set a price for marrying his daughter of defeating seven bulls, which Krishna did by expanding himself into seven forms, which was very nice for Satya, because considering that Krishna already had five other wives at that point, he was showing Satya, hey, I can expand myself and be with each of my wives simultaneously. Then Krishna married Bhadra. Bhadra was the daughter of the sister of Kunti and Vasudeva. So she was the daughter of Krishna's paternal aunt. And her brother and father gave Krishna Bhadra. In chapter 58 of the 10th canto, it says her brother gave her to Krishna. And in chapter 83, she says that her father gave her to Krishna. So I assume it was both her father and brother. Then Krishna married Lakshmana. And in chapter 58 of the 10th canto, it simply said that Krishna snatched her as Garuda stole the nectar at her swayamvar. In chapter 83, Lakshmana gives a very detailed and wonderful, wonderful description. I really highly recommend that you read, if we had time, I would read it to all of you. Lakshmana's descriptions of her marriage with Krishna, how her father set a test, like Satya's father with the seven bulls, but this one was Krishna had to shoot a toy fish that was hanging from the ceiling covered by a cloth reflected in water. And nobody could even lift the bow or string the bow. A few people could lift and string the bow. Arjuna was able to lift the bow, string the bow, and graze the fish, but only Krishna was able to hit the fish directly in the eye just by glancing at its reflection in the water. This he did at high noon, at which time Lakshmana came with her curling hair and her tinkling angle bells, shyly looking from side to side as she garlanded the Lord with a pure gold necklace. In addition to those eight chief queens, Krishna also married 16,100 queens, among which the main one, called Rohini, different from the Rohini who's Balaram's mother, obviously. She speaks about how they were captured by Krishna's own son, Bhomasura, the son of Bhumi and Varaha, and how he had captured these young princesses from their homes, and he had molested them and abused them, so that by Vedic standards they were unfit to be married to anyone. But when Krishna saved them, ostensibly to take back the earring and umbrella of the devas, they all said, Krishna, would you marry us? And Krishna, being the friend of the poor, Dina Bandhu, the savior of the fallen, he agreed to marry all of them. And in one wonderful ceremony in Dwarka, where he expanded himself into 16,100 forms, he married all of them in great pomp and splendor and gave each of them a palace. Now, the gopis also in Raja, they also underwent various austerities. We read about the unmarried gopis, how in the winter, and if you've been in Vrindavan in the winter, it's cold. You know, at night it gets down to Fahrenheit 40 degrees. It's cold. And they went out early in the morning to bathe in the Yamuna, as it says here, snana, to take bath in the Yamuna. They were undergoing austerity. They were eating only just mung beans and rice cooked without spices. I know of one devotee who also does that vow in the winter, and he said it's like eating solid air. You know, just food that's completely unpalatable, and eating that only for 1 month. And they weren't putting any oils or lotions on their bodies. They weren't doing any kind of decoration for their bodies, which meant, of course, their natural beauty was exhibited. And they were making a deity of Katyayani, of Durga. And they were offering, as it says here, religious rites. They were praying to her, please may Lord Krishna become my husband. So here Prabhupada says that this stage of having Krishna as our husband, as our beloved, or whatever our original rasa is, our factual identity, is earned after many lives of penance. Bahunam janmanam mante yanamam prapadjante vasudevam sarvamiti sa mahatma sudur labaha. Also states in the Bhagavatam, the cowherd boys, they were playing with Krishna after keeping up pious activities for thousands of lifetimes. So it's not cheap to attain Krishna. not cheap to attain Krishna. One must be willing to go through some trouble. So what is our goal in life? Now, we can understand what is our goal in life by looking backwards. What do we do austerity for? What kind of austerity do we do? Who do we think we are? Who do we think our identity is? How do we identify ourselves? What's my sense of self? What kinds of sacrifices do I do? And what do I think will make me happy? Do I allow myself to be distracted from my goal of serving Krishna by the so many I have to do this and I have to do that in this world? You know, illusion is going to constantly distract us from our real purpose. Okay, all right, before I can chant my rounds, I've got to take care of this. Well, okay, before I can really chant Hare Krishna with attention, I've got that this thing has to be taken care of, and then there's this problem. And well, as soon as I take care of this problem, then I'll be able to focus on my spiritual life. Well, after I do this thing, then I'll be able to be a good devotee. As soon as I do this thing. No, if we actually want to attain Krishna, then we have to say my primary, my real, my factual, as Prabhupada says here, identity, is that I am an eternal servant of Krishna. I am his soul. My goal, what is my goal? My goal is to actually, what does it say here? So wonderful. Pibantiya adaram amritam. To drink the amrita. Amrita. So it's such a nice word. Amrita is death. Amrita. That which conquers over death. That which conquers over death, which gives life. Adara. Adara means the lips. Adaram maduram. The beginning of the madhurastika. Adaram maduram. The sweet lips, Krishna's lips are so sweet, to be drinking this death-defying, life-giving nectar. That's my goal. Why conquering death? What is this death? Death means constantly getting a new false identity. Taking a false identity, losing it, taking another false identity, losing it, taking another false identity, with the corresponding set of goals and austerities, doing that for a while, with great pain, having it wrenched away, then again with great pain and suffering, building it again, that is birth and growth. Amritam, conquering death, giving my real life, that is the nectar of Krishna's lips, that is my goal. And what is the proper sacrifice to achieve it? Harinam, 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 Eva Kevalam, Kaloana Sevana, 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 Gatiranita. What is my real bath? My real bath is bathing myself in these names. Chanting with the heart, chanting with emotion. I want Krishna. I wanted to read a little bit from Madhurya Kadambini. That it's very nice talking about this stage of love. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that love for the Lord Prema assumes the form of a tender kiss, which is very nice because this verse is speaking about kissing the Lord, attracts Krishna and makes him appear to the devotee for a moment. At that time, all the senses of the devotees become the receptacles of all the auspicious qualities of Krishna. Right? Says, first the Lord reveals his beauty to the devotee. Then he reveals his touch. And then it says, he gives the taste from his own lips. That's what we're reading about today. Interestingly, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, the taste of Krishna's lips is only given to those in the conjugal rasa. But we can find at the same time that the taste of Krishna's lips in another way is available to everyone. In fact, it is available to us even now in the form of the prasad. When we offer food to Krishna, according to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we are relishing the taste of Krishna's lips. We are relishing the sweetness of Krishna's lips. So this hankering this hankering to do this. This should be the Lord of our, the goal of our life. As Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says here, that the Lord says, O best of devotees, many births you have given up wife, house, and wealth for my sake, and out of obligation to serve me, you have endured the miseries of cold, wind, hunger, thirst, and pain, tolerated the contempt of other men, taking to a life of begging. In payment for all your sacrifice, I cannot give you anything. I have become your debtor. Since lordship over the whole earth, taking the post of a demigod, and acquisition of mystic powers are unsuitable for you, how can I give them to you? One cannot give grass and straw, the enjoyment of cows, to any human being. Though I am unconquerable, I have just now been conquered by you. I live for you and dance for you. I am hanging on to the creeper of your good qualities for support. So that is what the Lord says to the devotee who is intent on the supreme goal of life. So that should be our focus, not allowing ourselves to become distracted, doing just the bare minimum in order to function properly in this world in Krishna's service, and focusing our priority and our primary energy on what is my identity, what is my goal, and doing the proper austerities to achieve that goal. And the austerities we do to achieve that goal are not painful like other austerities, Kevala Nandakanda. They are simply joyful. Unlike just religious rites and mystic knowledge and food of action and the culture of knowledge that Prabhupada mentions here, bhakti from the beginning is joyful. Even from the beginning of bhakti, pibanti adaram amritam, we can drink the nectar of Krishna's lips in the form of wonderful prasadam. Even someone just coming to prasadam for the first time without having undergone any austerity can drink this nectar of Krishna's lips. So what a nice process. Why would we want to be diverted to anything else? Why take up any other identity, any other goal, or any other process? When even in neophyte, in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement under the shelter of Srila Prabhupada, can be drinking this nectar of Krishna's lips, which destroys the death that we have to continually undergo in material existence, and gives us the real life of our factual identity. So thank you very much. We have a little bit of time here. If anyone has questions or comments or corrections or chastisements.
Okay, I've unmuted everybody on free conferencing. So if there's any questions or comments.
Yeah, I have a question. How could we attain pure bhakti when we still have to deal with the material world to some degree to keep body and soul together?
Don't see it as a material world. See it as Krishna's energy, as part of your bhakti. But make the priority on Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam. Make that the priority. Make that the priority on a daily basis in terms of time and energy. Make that the priority in terms of your heart and your emotions. And see everything you have to do in this world as part of your service. Bhaktivinoda Thakura has a nice song like that. See your home as Krishna's home. See your relatives as Krishna's servants that you are maintaining and you are helping. See your body as belonging to Krishna, just like a vehicle that belongs to someone else that you're maintaining. And put this, your energy, your priority of energy into your direct service.
Hare Krishna. I'd like to know, is Rukmini a direct expansion of Radharani? Do you know?
In one sense, every Shakti Tattva is an expansion of Radharani. In fact, Srila Prabhupada says that all of us jivas are expansions of Radharani. sometimes we, generally he says we're all expansions of Krishna, but sometimes he says we're all expansions of Srimati Radharani. That doesn't mean that we're not individuals. We are individual persons. So Rukmini is an individual person. Satyabhama is an individual person. Satyabhama has the mood, the same, a similar mood to that of Radharani, and Rukmini has a similar mood to that of Chandravali. I think that's the best I can do.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody else?
Yes, Madam Mila, I also have a question. Is it all right, for example, for a warrior, kshatriya, to learn martial arts to offer them in the service of Krishna?
Well, I think it's not only all right, it's recommended by the Lord. In the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita and the 18th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is very clear to Arjuna that what surrender means is taking your nature and using it in Krishna's service. He's very clear on that point. Very end of Bhagavad Gita, it's one of the very last points that Krishna makes. He says, you have your nature, you're not going to be able to repress your nature, you shouldn't take up the nature of somebody else, and choices are use it in Krishna's service, in which case Krishna will personally guide you and you will achieve perfection, or use it in Maya's service, in which case that you'll be defeated and all of your hopes will be shattered. And he says that your nature is your nature, and if you think you're just going to give up your nature, it will manifest anyway. I'm paraphrasing here. So if someone has the nature of a kshatriya and thinks, well, that's not a very good nature, let me have somebody else's nature, the kshatriya nature will manifest anyway. It will just manifest in an unpalatable way. We should mention that the main feature of the nature of a kshatriya is that of compassion. The essential character of a kshatriya is compassion. A kshatriya is like a super father and basically sees that they should be taking care of society. Someone who's a kshatriya is going to be very inclined to what we call social welfare work. A kshatriya is somebody who collects money and redistributes it rather than generating money. They collect it and redistribute it, ideally in the form of taxes or rent, but it might also be in the form of charity in the modern time if you're not in a literal governmental position. So kshatriyas are people who want to provide, they want to make sure people are taken care of. They want to make sure there's hospitals, old age homes, schools, good roads, buildings in good working condition. That's the mood of a kshatriya, and if necessary, they're certainly willing to fight also to protect the people that they're taking care of. Kshatriyas also are willing to fight if they see that someone else is not doing a good job of caretaking. They're willing to fight to wrench control of that from them. So therefore we see this concept of, you know, a kshatriya getting another kingdom. If they see another kingdom is ill-managed, then they'll fight with that king and wrest control away so that they can, why? Not so they can have power, but so they can take care of the citizens. A kshatriya is also very interested in concepts of justice and in morals and ethics. So if that's what you see as your nature, that you have a high interest in morals and ethics and in justice, that you find it unbearable to see somebody else mismanaging something and harming people, that you have an urge to take over and take care of people yourself, that you really like taking care of people. You really, not necessarily that you're the caretaker, like that you're, you know, changing somebody's bedpans, but you want to make arrangements for people to be cared for, and that you have a tendency both to attract a lot of wealth, to collect a lot of wealth, and then to redistribute it for people's benefit. So that's the main thing that a kshatriya does. Learning martial arts and being out on the battlefield is secondary. That's done only when necessary in order to take care of people. And certainly that should be done in the service of Krishna. So right now we have our ISKCON society, and there are many other devotee societies forming. But in none of these societies, including ISKCON, is there a system for the care of the devotees. So we don't really have systems for hospitals and old age homes and schools and proper running water and help to get people get married and all these sort of things that should go on in a society, although Prabhupada called it the international society, are very conspicuous by their absence. And that most of us who want to be devotees of Krishna are therefore simply subject to the whims of the government in which we live, in the country in which we live. So we end up being taken care of by the German government or the Indian government or the American government, and depending on the corruption or the actual caregiving of our government, we get the services that we need. But certainly there's a great need for there to be persons who want to take care of others, who are Rajarshis, who are deep devotees of the Lord, who can make sure that there's justice, that there's ethics, that there's morality, and that everyone is cared for. And this is, in my opinion, one of the greatest needs of the society as devotees, as we are truly growing into a society and not simply a small confederation of temples of renunciates. So that's mostly what a kshatriya should use in Krishna's service. Learning martial arts in Krishna's service is certainly fine, but that's not the main business of a kshatriya. And that's not the main way that a kshatriya should employ their propensities in Krishna's service. That's a subsidiary thing. It's not that a kshatriya is always off fighting battles. I mean, I'm sure some are, but even a policeman or a soldier, it's not that they're constantly fighting. The policeman is known as a peace officer. Keeping the peace, the use of violence is only when absolutely necessary.
Okay. Thank you, Amanda.
You just mentioned how the living entities are sometimes described as an expansion of Radharani. I was just speaking to one devotee. They were asking,
yes,
how is it that sometimes Krishna is described as the Supreme Self? And I try to explain that, well, Krishna is the source of everything.
And I'm
the source of all emanation. Is a big echo. And so therefore, in the ultimate sense, Krishna, there's nothing separate from him. But the reaction I was getting again and again was, well, that just sounds like Mayavad philosophy.
Well, you have to, you know, remember that our philosophy is Achincha Beta Beta Tattva. So it's not that we, and first of all, there's a difference between Brahmavadi and Mayavadi. But we don't say that the Brahmavadi philosophy is false. We say it's incomplete. So it's false in the sense that it's not the full truth. Like if you go to court, they say, do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? So a half-truth is more dangerous than a lie. But a half-truth is still a truth. So Brahmavadi, the concept that we are all one, that Krishna is the Supreme Self, is true. It's not that it's false. It's that that's not the whole truth. It's not everything. But it is true. So it depends how you're looking at things. Are you going to look at things from the position that one is separate, and that we're different persons with different identities eternally? Or are you going to look at it that we're all one? And that's also true eternally. Now, Mayavada is a little different. Mayavada is saying not only that everything is ultimately one, but Mayavada philosophy also says that Maya doesn't exist at all. Rather than saying it appears like something other than what it is, they say it isn't anything at all. It's quite a difference. You know, I can say when I'm having a dream, it appears to be real, although it's not. Or I could say, well, when I'm having a dream, actually nothing's happening. No, something's happening. You know, when you watch a movie, something's happening. There's lights on the screen. At another time, there were actors. It's not what it appears to be, but it is something. But Mayavada says it's nothing. It just doesn't exist at all. So that's one feature of Mayavada that's different from Brahmavada, Another feature of Mayavad is they say that the form of the Lord is illusion. The form of the Lord doesn't exist at all. That when the Lord incarnates, that's actually a manifestation of the mode of ignorance. So that's Mayavad philosophy. Mayavad philosophy says the Lord has no potency. So we don't accept Mayavad philosophy at all. But Brahmavad we do accept. We just say that it's not everything. You know, we're talking in this verse and purport about the conjugal rust. So even in this world, we say that when people marry, the two become one. We talk about a union. We talk about marriage as union. Right now, there's all this propaganda about gay marriages, and they also had things called civil unions, that people are in union. What does union mean? Uni means one. So does that mean that the husband and wife lose their individual identity? No, but there is a kind of union, you know, in sexual intercourse, there's a physical union. In emotional intercourse, in when one has a close emotional relationship with someone, there's another kind of union, but still the people are separate. They're still separate people. You know, when the child is in the womb of the mother, that's a real union, but they're still separate people. This idea that the mother can abort the child because the child is just part of her own body is madness. It's a separate person. Yet there's union. There is very strong union. I mean, even if you want to take like cases of what's called Siamese twins or conjoined twins, where two people are literally sharing, you know, part or even sometimes most of their body. But still, they're two separate people. Although there's union and there's difference. So you can talk about a husband and wife as being one and having a union, and that's true. It's not that it's not true. It is true. You can talk of them as one unit. At the same time, they're two separate people. So both are true, and both are absolutely true. In the case of our situation with Krishna, both are absolutely true. We are absolutely, fully, completely, totally one with Krishna always. And we are absolutely, totally, completely, and fully separate from Krishna always. Therefore, it's called achincha, achincha beta beta tattva, because you're, what? Huh? It's inconceivable. How can Krishna be the self of the self, and yet I'm a separate person? So it depends on your perspective. Sometimes we're looking more at oneness, sometimes we're looking more at the difference, sometimes we try to look at both together. We will say very definitely that Srila Prabhupada's preaching emphasizes the difference. Nirvisesa sanyavadi paskacha desha tarane. Because there's been so many people who either only emphasize the oneness or present the oneness in terms of Mayavad philosophy. Therefore, our emphasis is on the difference. However, we fully, completely accept the oneness. And there are times, if we look at the rasa of the conjugal love here with the gopis, Vajrasriyaha. So I'm sure somebody here can think of times when a time in the Leela when the oneness was manifested. Anybody remember that time?
I don't know.
Somehow whoever's speaking is breaking up.
No, I just said I have no idea.
When was the time in there was a time in the Rasa dance when very much it was manifested the oneness between the gopis and Krishna?
I remember a time when the gopis were remembering Krishna when he was hiding from them.
Yes.
And they were playing his pastimes.
Yes.
And one gopi even said, "I am Krishna." She was playing the part of Krishna.
Yes, exactly. So it's explained, the acharya explained that when the gopis were playing the part of Krishna, one of them was saying, "I'm going to suck food in his breast. I'm going to lift Govardhan Hill. I'm going to take down Trinavarta. I'm going to steal the gopis' clothes." When the gopis were doing that, they fully felt that they were Krishna. And Kavi Karnapur explains in Anandavrindavan Champu that Krishna fully entered into them.
This is also described outside of the conjugal rasa in terms of Prahlad Maharaj, that Prahlad Maharaj sometimes so much identified with Krishna that he felt there was no difference between him and Krishna. So that is also there. And we want that. We actually, I don't know where I was. I was out shopping the other day. And in the store, they were playing some song. It was a song I've never heard before. But the lyrics were something like, I want to lose myself in you. And I remember when I used to teach Gurukula, when we would study poetry, there was one famous poem like that. I want to lose myself in you in love. So we have some idea of this, that I'm in so much love with someone that I lose myself. And I feel that I become them and they become me. That there is some kind of merging. So that happens. That happens even in the Leela with Krishna and the gopis, with Prahlad Maharaj, that this concept of losing oneself in Krishna is certainly part of the Leela. At the same time, there's a sense of being a separate individual. I have my separate struggle eternally. Otherwise, how is there a sense of enjoying the oneness? If I fully become you and you fully become me, how can I then relish that union? I have to exist as a separate person to relish that. So both have to be there.
That was absolutely wonderful.
Anybody else?
Yes, Swamiji, I want to ask you one question. If Guru and disciples, they have similar nature, like both of them are really stubborn, can their relationship work?
It's distorted. Can you try to say it again, please?
I'll write it down.
Mataji, could you please repeat the question, because there's so much echo from your side, we couldn't make it out. Could you repeat? What's wrong?
Hello?
Yes.
Can you hear me now?
We can hear you now.
Okay. Mataji, if Guru and disciple, they have a similar nature, like both of them are really, really stubborn, can their relationship work?
Well, why not? People with similar relationships can get along, and people with different relationships can get along if the center is Krishna and if it's not exploitive.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you,
Dr. Ramananda Prabhu?
Yeah.
Did I post that correctly so that everybody can see it that is on the...
No, you just sent it to me. I'll post it, but there's many more people on. Conference and then on Skype today.
Okay, if you could post it. I found a Simple Temple, the video, the movie online on the dietary. And I'm so impressed looking at it again. And I'm so impressed with what Radhanath Swami on. Because, you know, as Irmala Didi was mentioning about the Kshatriyas, concerned with compassion, justice, you know, taking care of others, and, you know, this sort of thing should be manifesting in the leadership. And anyway, Radharaswami has created a model in Chaupati that's worthy of a lot of devotees to, you know, to pay attention to or to give some attention to. And even if the management wants to ignore this model, everybody should understand that this works. And so they should watch the movie. If you haven't seen the movie, you should watch it.
Thank you very much, Vidyagya Madhava Prabhu. I've spent quite a bit of time in Chaupati, and I can attest that it is definitely... In almost every respect, I mean, it's not perfect, but in almost every respect, it's a really incredible model of society building and care. Yeah, Thank you. Thank you very much. In fact, I'm very much working with some of the leaders of that yatra in trying to introduce a variety of models of care. So it's something that I'm quite involved in. Anybody else?
Mother Ermila?
Yes.
I have a question from the purport.
Yes.
There's a small passage at the beginning, or it's at the beginning of a sentence. It says, each and every living being has his individual position in one of the above mentioned five different kinds of reciprocating means with the Lord.
Yes.
So what I'm wondering is, a long time ago, I lived in the temple, 89, 90, 91, part of 92 in Honolulu, and I was a new devotee, and someone left. An established devotee. I don't know how long he had been there, but
he left.
And I was a little concerned because I thought Krishna consciousness had no end, and I thought, why would someone leave? Did he come to the end of Krishna consciousness? So another senior devotee there explained to me, and this is the question. Not everyone is a devotee of Krishna. Some people that come and serve Krishna for a while and then leave, they're actually servants of Lord Vishnu or Lord Srinivasa, or have some other position in the spiritual world. So was that incorrect thing for that devotee to say to me?
I think that's one of the most unusual explanations I've ever heard for why somebody would stop their Krishna conscious behaviors. It's definitely unusual. I think we see that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is able to accommodate everyone. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had devotees in his lila who were more attached to Ramchandra, for example, than to Krishna. And some of them became devotees of Krishna by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's association, and some of them didn't. Murari Gupta and Anuprama retained their affection and their loyalty for the Lord and his mood as Ramachandra. So my understanding is that everybody has a place in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement. But as far as why do people give up their... You know, I think there's two questions. One is, why do people join or leave a particular association of devotees? And the other is, why do people stop their practice of Krishna consciousness? And those two things are not necessarily parallel. In other words, we have people who belong, many people, who belong to a society of devotees, whether ISKCON or another society, who are not really practicing Krishna consciousness more than in a very minimal way. Many, many people. I wouldn't be surprised if it's a fairly large percentage. And then we have other people whose affiliation with the society of devotees is very minimal, and they're very strict in their practice of Krishna consciousness. So those two things are not exactly the same thing. So if you say, why does somebody leave a particular association, that is due to as many reasons as there are people. And if you ask, why do people give up their practices, that's also for as many reasons as there are people. I think we can categorize, if we're talking about why people give up their practice, as rather than why. Am I still on?
Well, that was my question at the time. Now my
why
question
people
is,
give up their practice? I'd say that generally the categories are offenses to devotees. That's a really big one. Offenses to the holy name, especially inattention to the holy name and attachment, maintaining attachment to material things in spite of understanding so many instructions on this matter. I think those are the prime reasons. Disobeying the orders of Guru, which Prabhupada says is a serious offense, committing sin on the strength of chanting. I'd say that those are the main reasons why people give up their practice. If you want to look at it psychologically, My understanding is that if you don't progress very quickly through the anartha nivritti stage, it's difficult to maintain your vows. That's a difficult stage. It's a stage at which you're kind of like a riven cloud, and unless you are happy to take that bath to wash away the false ego, that you may end up going back to materialistic life. As to why people leave an organization, that's really a different question, and sometimes that has to do with personality clashes and political things and mismanagement and that kind of thing. And then there's, you know, degrees of leaving and degrees of staying. Sometimes people partially stay, partially leave. I don't think you can give one answer. Now, it could be that some people join ISKCON and then leave ISKCON because they're more attached to Lord Narayan, and maybe they'd rather hang out with the Sri Vaishnavas who worship Lord Narayan. And so they become more affiliated with that branch of Vaishnavism. That may be. There may be some people in that category. Although the devotees I know who are very attached to the Sri Vaishnavas are certainly devotees of Krishna and not of Narayan, but it may be that there are people like that.
So everyone on this planet has one of those five relationships with Krishna.
Well, you could have one of those relationships with Krishna in a form other than Krishna.
So when no one on the planet is destined to go to another Vaikuntha planet?
I don't think it's like that. I think that everyone has their preferred form of the Lord that they worship and their performed rasa, their preferred rasa.
Thank you.
Okay, anything else, Prabhu?
Yeah, what Prabhupada says here is each and every living being has an individual position in one of the above mentioned five different kinds of reciprocating means with the Lord. He doesn't say with the Lord in his form of Krishna, and he doesn't say with the Lord of his form of Krishna in Vraja. So some people are eternally in Mathura, some eternally in Ayodhya, and some are in more than one place at a time. I thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
All glories to Srila Prabhupada. All glories to the ladies of Hastinapur. To
Jai.
Swami,
Jai.
And to all the electronically assembled Vaishnavas.
Jai.
Jai. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.